Welcome to the Universal Sisterhood podcast. We're hoping to create a place where women can delve deeper, lift their gaze higher, live freer, laugh louder, smile brighter, and be the authentic woman they were designed to be. Every human heart is created to be known, loved, and understood. So this is the place where women can share their stories. Hi friends, in today's interview I interview Sister Mary Julian. She is a Sister of Mercy of Alma, Michigan. She is a religious sister, of course. She is 44 years old. She is young, youthful, vibrant, full of life and joy, which you will hear. And I really wanted to interview a nun because I wanted to highlight the fact that we're all sisters and we're all made up of this body of Christ, and we don't need one more than the other. We need everyone and everyone's gifts and talents. And I just wanted to highlight that this is the universal sisterhood, and that includes everybody. So I hope you enjoy the interview. Rate us on iTunes, leave us a review, share us with a friend. Enjoy.
I'm so excited to have our next guest on the podcast, Sister Mary Julian. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Would you like to start by giving us a little bit of background information about who you are?
Okay, so.
Or who you were?
Who I was, yeah. Well, my religious name is Sister Mary Julian, as you said. I'm a religious Sister of Mercy of Alma, Michigan. But I'm Australian, so I spent, well, it would be now half of my life, exactly half of my life in Australia. And
goes so fast.
It does go fast. It really goes fast. And so I grew up in Sydney with my parents and a brother and sister.
And you were the middle child.
I was the middle child.
Did you have middle child syndrome?
Apparently. Yeah, apparently I have middle child syndrome, but...
apparently I had it too.
Do you? Oh, you're a middle child.
Well, I'm middle girl.
Apparently I'm a classic middle child, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. I still don't really know what that means.
No, me either.
But,
maybe we're in denial. Anyway.
So, I, went to Catholic schools all my life, brought up in a Catholic family, but not,
overly,
I'd say pious, but we went to Mass on Sunday. That was the extent we pray at meals, but that was probably the extent,
yeah.
I think. And then went to Catholic school.
Were there pictures around the house?
Yeah, there were a lot of pictures of Our Lord, mm-hmm. a couple of Our Lady, but I wouldn't say, like, there were no shrines or
yeah.
anything particular, but certainly, like, little statues every now and again in the kitchen or on the mantle, but not...
Nothing of Berkeley.
Nothing really... I think people walking with... would know it's a Catholic house, but it wasn't.
Yeah. There was no shrine or...
No shrine or...
Sort or of chapelet.
Yeah, no chapelet, yeah. But I think the main... People knew we were Catholic because we weren't afraid to talk about our faith when we liked to discuss religion and politics, the two things you usually don't. But yeah. So people who
and
came
age.
To the house... And age. Definitely avoided age. So we talked a lot about that growing up. So it was always... that kind of inculcated a habit to talk about the faith and be proud of it and not be afraid of it. We had a lot of debates, though, with people who were interested, not arguments mm-hmm. so much, who didn't share the faith but were interested in why we found it important in our lives, even just why we went to Mass on a Sunday. So mm-hmm. that was very important to me because, my dad didn't go to Mass when I was growing up. He mm-hmm. wasn't practicing until... probably my high school.
Mm.
And that was through an encounter with a priest who kind of invited him back to come back to the church. So I remember that day, I was 15, when Dad joined us for Mass on a Sunday, and it was distinct in my mind because it was a sorrow that he wouldn't join us. And Mum faithfully every Sunday would take us to Mass.
Mm.
And, you know, she never sort of chided Dad in front of us for not going. She said, you know, one day maybe he'll come. That impressed me deeply, and I remember being in Mass with her one time. I was 9 years old, and I was really bored, and I just thought, it's boring. But I looked at her and she was so interested. Like, she was listening to the parts of the Mass and then to the homily with such interest, like genuine interest, that I was struck by what was it about the Mass that she really wanted to know and wanted to be in. So I decided, well, maybe if I pay attention, I might get something too that How interests beautiful. Me like her.
I heard somebody say once that mum's deaf at the consecration. So whenever the kids are like, you know, she cannot hear them. Yeah. She's completely absorbed.
I think it's a beautiful gift of mothers because that's their time with the Lord. And like that really struck me. And it was actually that moment that I began to pay attention to the Mass more and love the Mass.
So from nine?
From nine. I used to love the Mass. And I was no Saint Teresa, you know, who was like, had this epiphany about religious life at that point. But I just
knew it had value.
Knew it had value. And then I really started to enjoy my faith, if that makes sense. Mm. And then I started reading a lot more spiritual books about different things and about the saints. I love the books about the saints. And I really felt like a prodding. Maybe I'd be called to be a sister. But I never saw any growing up in Australia. I didn't see any religious sisters. And so I just thought they didn't exist anymore. And this was a way of life that has been and gone.
Yeah.
So I wondered why there was this stirring. And I wasn't worried about it. But then it came up again when I was 11.
How did
it? In the sense of, I remember reading that St. Bernadette. And I took her as my confirmation.
Me too.
Did you?
And I regretted it. You know, it's just so superficial. I'm thinking, that's such a gross name. Why did I choose that? Like, there was nothing, you know, religious about it. It was really bad of me.
No. She's still your friend. She's your confirmation.
Oh, no. Now I have a much better love of her and understanding. But back then.
I guess we think about, we choose our snakes for different reasons, don't we? I mean, I just, and in fact, it was because my sister was asthmatic. And when I read St. Bernadette was an asthmatic, I was really drawn to that. So it was not exactly a pious reason either. It was just because I had seen what asthma does to somebody. And I thought, wow, she didn't complain. I mean, my sister didn't complain either. But reading that St. Bernadette's life, how poor she was, and oh, gosh, that's really interesting. I just found it interesting. Yeah. So it wasn't. So
have you been to Lourdes?
I have since. Yeah.
Same. So it was beautiful. Yes. So I fell in love with her.
Yeah, that's, and it was really then that you sort of appreciate, I think. It was later for me as well.
Yeah.
I thought about that, and again, it's like, well, where are they today? Like, where are the sisters? And I just let it go out of my mind again. I thought, well, maybe I'm just called to be married and that would be okay. I'll just, you know.
Mm.
But in my heart of hearts, I always still wanted to be a sister, and I felt very much that he was calling me just to be his own, and that never ever left.
Wow.
So even later when I'd go out, date guys or just be with friends, I always loved my friends and I enjoyed going out with these guys. I enjoyed the company. I just, something didn't feel quite right. Like, I just couldn't enter into any deeper relationship with a guy because I felt like somehow for me this wasn't right. Of course, you know, friends and other people, I mean, who they eventually got married. And there was nothing wrong with that, obviously. I never thought there ever was. I thought it was beautiful. And I wondered, what's wrong with me? Like, what on earth is wrong with me? And people would, some of my friends would be like, what's wrong with you? Like, even at uni. And I couldn't really give them an answer. I just said, I'm just, you know, I'm not ready. It's like, but you're 21. So that was really sort of, that's,
was there ever a sense of fear?
In regard to
your being a sister? Yeah,
there was. I mean, in the sense of when I made the decision actually, a sense of I don't really know what this means, but never a fear of not following it because from the time after uni, I graduated from uni and then worked in Sydney for a while. Then I went overseas to Italy. And in fact,
why were you there?
So I thought I was feeling this very restless in Sydney. And I thought it was because I was living in Australia. And I'm blaming poor Australia for everything, all my woes. So I thought, I'll just leave. I'll go overseas because, you know, I'm half Italian. I'll, you know, see the world. I'll teach English, get some money, enjoy life. And maybe my restlessness will stop. Well, yeah. It just got worse. So I taught English in a school for 8 months.
What, in Rome?
In Rome, right in the Vatican. Oh. So I'd be standing. Exactly. I'd be standing in class just, you know, teaching some part of the English language. I remember distinctly thinking, what am I doing here? I'm just not happy.
Mm.
And I looked out of the window and there's the Dome of St. Peter's. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. Like, I can't get any closer to the Lord
mm.
than being in the Eternal City, and I still feel unhappy and restless. So it actually made things worse. So yeah. I remember being near St. Peter's one time, writing a letter to a friend saying, I really want to get out of Rome. It's just, again, I'm blaming the place.
Yeah.
It's really not a good place, and I'm feeling really restless. And I wrote these words, I feel like I have to stay because something bigger is around the corner, but I don't know what it is.
Hmm.
I never sent that letter. I kept it because that afternoon I was sitting in the colonnades at St. Peter's. I seemed to dwell there. I'd be going to mass every day.
Someone
was drawing me in. And I remember reading the biography of St. Joseph this year, just kind of the autobiography, just came across it. And I thought, I'll read that. And I remember her saying there that she prayed to St. Anne. She's like, you know, Jesus' grandmother,
mm-hmm.
she'll never refuse us anything. I thought, well, I'm going to pray to St. Anne for my vocation, so I don't know what's going on.
Isn't your mother's name Anne?
She's Diana. So Diana, Anne's in the name. There's still Anne in the name. So I prayed to St. Anne because I was getting really restless at this point. And I thought, I left Australia because I thought Australia's so secular, and here I'm in Rome, which is not secular, but mm-hmm. I'm actually feeling worse. So what is it? And I remember just being in this state of agony, thinking, what do you want from me, Lord? Like, and I asked Our Lady, I asked St. Anne, show me what the Lord wants for me. I can't stand this tension. And I was going out of the colonnade to St. Peter's, and I literally I saw this sister from our community. And I'd seen her before in the school I was teaching at, but I was kind of afraid. When you talk about fear, I was afraid to talk to her because I wanted to speak to her, but I didn't know what to say. Like, how do you speak to a nun?
Mm.
But she looked so joyful and just at peace. So when I saw her again, I saw her and I greeted her, so I knew her really well, but I mean, I've seen her once. So I'm like, hello, and she looks at me and she's like, oh, hello, thinking he's just a strange person. So we ended up just talking right there in the street. And it was like 3 hours. It was unbelievable. So I'm just like telling her my life story, which is incredible. She had such patience. And she said at the end, she said, have you ever thought you might have a religious vocation? And her question was my answer. Like, I felt this incredible peace. It just washed over me like these floodgates opened and this beautiful peace was rushing in. That was the answer.
Mm.
And so we, you know, she said, you know, here's my number. Call me if you want to. We'll do some gardening or something. So I was elated, and I was staying with my aunt and grandmother at the time, and they couldn't really fathom, and I couldn't explain to them what had just happened. So I met with this sister again, and then I ended up meeting the community. But the really interesting thing was the day that I met that sister, at the end of the conversation, she said, look, I'm sorry, I have to go. Poor thing, with being 3 hours. Of course she had. And she said, I'm going to mass.
She was the feast of St.
Anne. Exactly.
Aww.
And I thought, it's the feast of St. Anne. It was a joke on the name. And but so I thought, now that's amazing. And then that evening they were celebrating the feast day of one of the sisters, the superior was Mother Anne. So I thought, well, she's definitely taking care of me. So
did you go to mass with her?
I didn't go to mass with her because I was having to go back to class, class and teach another class. So, but she invited me to come to the celebration. So I met the other sisters and I thought, this is where I
belong.
Yeah. But then when I actually went, I was more afraid that it wouldn't happen than that it would. It was only, you know, later when I became a sister, and I, you know, it was based in America. I'd never been there before. And I had never really wanted to go to America, to be honest. I had a map in my room growing up. All the places of interest were Europe. And America just didn't have any dots.
Didn't rate.
And of course, that's where he sends me. And it's not because I hated it. I wasn't interested. And so I found it interesting that he sent me there. And I remember the
day. So what's the time span? From
when I met the sisters and their community, it was a week and a half. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It was one of those things where I'd been praying so long to know my vocation that when he told me, he really told me. The Lord works with different people in different ways. So it was a week and a half. So in that time, I quit my job.
In 10 days, 12 days.
Yeah, and I just couldn't really give it. It was terrible. I mean, I couldn't give him an explanation. I said, I can't work anymore. And then I called my parents, which was, God bless them. I mean, I called them and I said, look, I have some news. I'm going to America. I'm becoming a nun and I'm not coming back to Australia. I don't know how long for. So my poor parents are like, will we ever see him again? Like,
how did they take it?
Well, really, they were really, they said they were shocked, but not surprised, but they were very, really shocked. They were in shock. And my mum's like, this is crazy. Like, this is just so, like, spontaneous. And
have you given it much thought? Well, yes, since I was nine.
And then I was like, you know, my dad's like, have you ever seen a cult? I'm like, well, my answer is not helpful. Well, I don't know.
I've only just been with them for a week and a half.
And so then it was not helpful. And then I think of it now and I think, oh, my poor parents, like they took a leap of faith, this crazy daughter. But then so we ended the conversation and I remember they called back and it was – and Dad said, look, you know,
you might we've had a glass support. Of wine and
yeah, we – and the, so we've talked about, like, do you need anything, like, you know. And ironically, by the time I had that call and – he called the second time. I'd been robbed of my money that I was going to use for my ticket to get to America by some gypsies.
From on you?
On me. So my bag, I mean, it's one of those moments people who've been to Rome know. Yes. You know, they come up and they. So anyway, I went, only found that out once I got to the place. But the timing that my dad called was just when I found out. So
he actually
helped
me.
Money. It's like, I need money, exactly. And so that was all taken care of. But it was I really, to this day, I'm so edified by their leap of faith because it was just garble what came out of my mouth. Mm.
So you were processing this for the last however many years and they had never.
They hadn't, yeah. And I never had thought to talk to them about it because it just wasn't really a reality in my mind. Mm. Again, my idea of it was idealistic, I guess, and I hadn't seen it incarnated in any person.
Yeah.
You know? So
your discernment process was long but actually really short.
Long but short, yeah, exactly. That's a good way to say it. It was long but once.
Quick.
Once,
what is it? Jesus writes with a leg. God writes with the leg of a table when he wants to tell you something. Like it's in big, thick letters.
Yeah. And that was the case. It was really clear in my mind. But
that's beautiful.
But it took some time to get there. But then once I knew, that was it. And
did you have a moment of, like, when you're in America, is it a novice?
Yes, a postulant first and a novice.
So were there times of, what am I doing?
Absolutely. So I really, halfway, like at the beginning it was very much a lot of energy.
Honeymoon novelty, kind of period.
Period, exactly. And then halfway through, I was realizing,
halfway through is how long?
Oh, sorry, halfway through postulants is after about 6 months.
Uh-huh.
When, you know, you start feeling like an idiot because you've never been a nun before and you're learning everything and you're breaking things.
And you kind of have this stereotypical idea of what
absolutely.
A nun is.
Yeah, it's like they've got to be these perfect.
Seeing
all day and doing everything right and, you know, always being holy and not having these thoughts of what am I doing here. And,
yeah.
And also adjusting to the culture. So that was a huge thing. I got really homesick. And I actually became really sad.
Loving Sydney.
Loving Sydney, exactly. I thought, why did you bring me all the way here? And I just said, look, you know, I'm here, so I trust you. But I was really homesick.
Mm.
But I had a really good classmate and the sisters were great. So I kind of got through that. But yeah, it was hard because there was the cultural shift, but also learning to become a sister, a sister of mercy. So what the charism was about,
Can you explain charisms?
Yeah, so charism, so there's the individual charisms and then there's, so charisms to, a religious community has a charism. So I know what's been written about individual charisms, that's, I'm not very good at explaining those, but people do have individual charisms. But for the religious community is given a charism, a gift, by the Holy Spirit for a particular reason. So for the Sisters of Mercy, the charism is mercy, so to elevate out of misery,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's sin or, you know, physical misery or an ignorance, so like or a psychological misery. And that in our community is expressed in an apostolic way through healthcare or education or mm-hmm. education. So some of our sisters are doctors, nurses. We have a surgeon, psychiatrist, psychologists. But then also.
So are they those professions before they become sister no, or do they
not
study?
Not necessarily. Most of them they study as a sister to mm-hmm. become those.
Wow, that's beautiful.
It is. And it's really something that struck me as beautiful because they're studying as sisters. So they're being trained as a sister to do this profession. But also educators. So
So the one in St. Peter's who was offered you gardening, what's
she was in education. She uh-huh. was so she was
Oh you saw at school, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, but she had also had an agriculture
mm-hmm.
Background as well before she entered. So our apostolic works express the charism. So that really, to me, struck me because the individual woman called to be a Sister of Mercy is her gifts are looked at, her natural gifts, her natural charisms as well. And those are used to discern, well, how is she being called to serve the church in this community? So that there's no, when we talk about a few hours, I was worried, or everyone's going to be the same and our individuality will be crushed. Like,
yeah.
You know, it wasn't.
Well, that's right. Our culture doesn't recognize sacrifice. I think that's why it's the thought of becoming a nun is so foreign to 99% yes. of the population.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So how can you explain that we automatically think that you are being deprived of individuality and yourself, you know, you have to wear certain clothes, you have to cover up, you have to do this, that and the other, you've got a strict timetable. Can you explain that?
Yeah, and it's so, and I think just first to make the analogy with motherhood, like mothers make incredible sacrifices too. I mean, good mothers who are really are committed. So it's an analogy, but with religious life, it is a sacrifice, but it's such a joy as well. And I think when you say this to young women or young, you know, people who are asking you, it seems incongruous. They just don't understand how you can. But because they see like, so what time do you get up in the morning? Or 4:30? Like, oh, what time do you go to bed at night? 10:30? But it's not just about.
Do you have Instagram? Do you have Facebook?
That's right. Yeah. Can you use the computer when you want? Can you go out when you want? Can you wear what you like? And a lot of the answers to that are no. But the reason is because you're being freed up for something else, which is to really live
freely,
freely for Christ.
Fully alive.
Fully alive, exactly. Mm. And you become really who you're meant to be as a person if you're called to be a religious sister. Like, I feel more who I am, who I always was as a sister than I could think any other profession or way of life. Like, it's a blossoming of the person through the vocation. And so in that sense, those things are a sacrifice, but the more you live religious life too, you understand he loved us first. You know, he sacrificed for us first, and it's in love. And so as you grow, this is a striving, you know, strive to grow in love for him and for each other in community, which can be hard because you don't choose who you live with. You learn that it's not as much of a sacrifice. Like you find there's always new things to sacrifice, but it's a deepening. And you want that deepening so much that the sacrifice is still a sacrifice, but it becomes more contextualized because it's in love. Mm. And it's always every day a yes. You say that yes every single day. And he'll always give you more opportunities to love him more. So it never stops.
Mm.
So the initial things you can look back and say, well, that's no longer a sacrifice, but he'll always bring you more things. But that's the nature of religious life. It's that call to holiness, as is marriage and other states. This particular way is poverty, chastity, obedience, and for us, service to the church is a fourth vow. So you never quite know what will be asked of you. And obedience is the greatest sacrifice because that clinging to what we want never goes away. You know, and you hope it gets more, we get more malleable, but we always have our darling Will, you know, as our mother family doesn't say, and that's always, there's always something to sacrifice on that part, you know. Yeah. So,
but I mean, when you do what you were made for,
yeah,
you are fully alive.
Absolutely.
And whether it is a, like, motherhood is hard. It's not for wimps.
Yeah.
But it's hard, but it also has its joys, and there's tremendous blessings, and if you look for them, and
If you have that, that's right. If you look for them and if you see them as blessings, and you're, you know, bringing that to prayer all the time. So prayer is everything, and really bringing it. But the Lord has become your friend, you know, more and more. So, but there's so much joy in religious life.
Yeah.
And people think, oh, what's so joyful about living giving with a bunch up. Of women and giving up all these things? It's incredible.
And we're chained down by, you know, social norms, and whereas you're not.
Yeah.
It kind of suffocates us, and we don't realize it. And that's why you're always so joyful.
We tried it. We've got a lot. We've been given a lot.
But
we should be.
Yeah.
You know, we should be joyful.
Yeah.
We have no right to not be joyful because we've been given so much.
How beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I know you don't see nuns, religious sisters at all. Oh, well, my daughter, who's 18, when she first saw a nun, I think she was about 7, and she's, "Mom, is that the lady from The Sound of Music?" Have you had any strange encounters with, like, you? I mean, walking from Notre Dame to your office, we walked through the city, and you know, I have never walked through the city with a nun before at my side.
Yeah,
and people look.
They do look, and it's funny. It's always at the beginning you notice it when you enter religious life, how much they look. But after a while, you don't know. It's people who you're with, like you say, you notice it more. But for the most part, I mean, I have to say personally, I've never had, except for someone, you know, when I was, I think, a novice who didn't have a good experience with the church, you know, said, "Oh, I can't understand why you'd ever choose to be a nun." I've never had anyone come up to me and sort of be derogatory or anything like that. It's often if you're shopping, or if I find myself shopping or walking down the street or in a church, just on a train or a bus, someone will come up and ask for prayers.
Really?
Or just chat. They'll say, "Sister, can you pray? I'm having an exam, you know, can you pray for my son, my daughter, my husband, my wife?" And
are they embarrassed to come up to you?
No,
do they do it quietly? Or
no, this is the thing. Some do it quietly. Some it's like, they'll just come right up. And the beautiful thing is it's all about him, because there's no preamble. But because we're in a habit, they know they can come, and they don't have to give a preamble to why they're coming. And I think that says a lot about them.
Yeah.
Their openness, their goodness, and their faith, because they'll just come up and they will thankfully and beautifully assume that you will receive them.
Yes.
Which is as it should be. And you listen and pray. So, yeah, people do respond. They do. Yeah, some people stare at you and think, "What are you?" A lot of times, two kids will look and say, "Is that a nun?" or "What's that?" Or, and the parents often like, "Sorry, never seen a nun before." But I love it when, you know, often mothers or dads will say, "Can you say what?" Or say a prayer, or can you explain to her or to him what a nun is? Because they've never seen one before. That's such a beautiful thing.
What do you say?
I'll just say, you know, I'm someone who's married to Jesus, which for a kid that sounds weird. But you say, you know, it's not not like mum and dad so much as a physical thing, but I wear a ring, and this is my my bridal veil, so it shows that I'm committed to Jesus, and so I live my life for him, to serve the poor and to help the poor. And kids actually are they get it. They do get it, and they'll ask questions too, like, usually, do you have to wear that all the time? So they kind of, through their questions, start to understand a little bit.
They're much more open to, and they don't have the inhibitions that we have.
The kids are great.
Yeah.
I love it when kids ask questions. I just think it's beautiful.
They're innocent.
They are innocent, absolutely.
What advice would you give to somebody who's not sure what the Lord's asking of her?
Number one thing, to pray. I mean, if they're not praying, to pray, but if they're praying, to keep praying and pray harder and persevere and not give up. even
you don't get an answer right away.
You don't get an answer right away. Yes, and you have to wait a long time. And they may not want to hear that for an answer, but it's prayer is everything. And to stay close to Christ and to keep and that they keep their eyes and ears open, because he will use people.
Mm.
He will use experiences. He'll use everything to reach that person and let them know what he wants. It can take a while. It may not take as long. But if it's a young woman, for example, discerning a vocation in religious life and they're not sure, to be open to that possibility means you have to make certain choices. So if, for example, you're discerning religious life, it's probably not the best idea to keep going out with guys. Like, you know, you've got to avail yourself for the Lord to do his work. If you really think this is not for you, then of course. But some may want a spiritual director to guide them. Some young women don't. They'd rather have a good friend, someone they trust, someone who's got faith, who will really accompany them. But the most important thing is they pray, they stay close to the Lord in the sacraments, and I keep asking him, you know, what is it, Lord, that you want for me, and help me to keep my eyes open. Help me to hear your will. And he really will speak, maybe in unexpected ways, but he does speak through other people too, or experiences. And I think that's everything. And to stay close to Our Lady.
Yeah.
You know, at baptism, all saints.
And to St. Anne.
Yes, definitely St. Anne. I have a special place for St. Anne now. But I think that really is the key.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Where would somebody find a spiritual director? Like, I know in America they've got a very different kind of system.
Yeah.
Confirmation is such a massive thing. Is that, like, from all the podcasts I've been listening to and everything, that, you know, the confirmation is a big turning point. They're 15.
Yeah.
When they make it.
Yeah.
They have a lot of exposure to, I suppose, youth groups and religious sisters that we don't have.
That's a really good question, and it's not easy, I think, because, as you say, in the States there's a lot of availability and there's also a lot more priests too.
Mm.
But we have good priests here too that I think if they're not sure about someone who could guide them in that, to ask a friend who they might be able to. I mean, sometimes parish priests are a good starting point. And if they don't feel they can direct, whether for whatever reason, someone, they might have some ideas. The archdiocese might have suggestions as well. But also, I think the main thing is those personal relationships, like asking someone, do you know of a good priest? Because they can find out if they're not sure themselves. Or it could be someone who has experience in direction. He's not necessarily a priest, but he's more experienced in spiritual direction. You know, there's wonderful people who are with their lay people, they're in different associations, who really have the capacity to guide us all. So I think starting off with someone who's practicing their faith, who could know and advise them where to go to, if they themselves don't already have someone they feel they could trust with that kind of a thing, because they could be afraid at the beginning.
Yeah.
And somehow starting the process means they'll end up in a convent tomorrow. But it's really, I think, through relationship.
Yeah.
With someone they trust first.
Yeah. That's right, with any relationship.
Absolutely.
You need to build trust. You need to, and that's with Jesus. Like, you don't have that. Things aren't a burden because you love him.
Exactly. They're not when you love, you do anything.
And yeah.
It's like no matter what state of life you're in, when you love, you do anything for that person. Mm. And it's exactly what you say. It's not a burden. It's a joy.
Mm.
And even if it's painful or you feel that it's going to demand a lot from you, you do it because you absolutely love them. And
you know it will bring you joy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Mm. Yeah.
So what does the future hold? For you,
that's a really good question. The great thing is I don't know. I pray to God that I pray I get to heaven, but it's a long road.
Yeah.
But the thing with religious life is that great thing of obedience. It's like it's hard because you don't quite know what the future holds. It's the most temporal part of our life. But, you know, as a sister, I know that I'll be guided by my superiors, you know, to what the Lord is asking of me. Even if I, you know, I can say to you now, I may be completely terrified of what I might be asked or really not like it, but I'll always know it with certainty that this is what God wants of me.
Mm.
You know, obviously reasonable, but I've not had experience of it never being reasonable, but that's my path, and it's freeing. So even though I don't know, I am in the here and now doing what I'm asked to do, and they'll
Not having that control, which
yes, that's right.
We're clasping, we're always clawing at control, and it's debilitating.
It is.
Whereas you've handed it over.
And it can still creep in. We can still want to know, and we can still want that. But it's the fact is, you don't know what you know will be asked.
But you know, nothing will be asked. You won't be asked too much.
No,
something in the sense, that you can't handle.
Exactly, nothing you can't handle, and that you have the grace. So that when you've made, you know, when I made my final vows and I profess poverty, chastity, obedience and service until death, those vows have an efficacy that when I'm in those moments of, I don't know that I can do this kind of thing, this particular thing is hard, I know and can call upon the grace of those vows, because every grace I need to do what I'm going to be asked to do was given at vows, and our graces are still given. So it's
and you like, feel that?
I do feel it. Mm-hmm. I feel it so free when I make final vows that I can get on with the work of being a sister. You know, there was always that kind of escape hatch the devil uses before you make the final vows, like, you know, the fact it's still possible, and it's like it's gone, it's closed permanently once you make that final vow. But it's so freeing because you know that he's got you, like you belong to him completely.
And just to kind of myth buster here, like just you still have to live with other women.
Exactly.
Like you still have those day-to-day kind of.
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone's
squabbles.
Got preferences.
Yeah.
I mean, look, how you pack and unpack the dishwasher can make or break a day. You know, it's like we all come to community with our preferences of the way we clean, the way we, you know, hold a conversation, the way we set the table, like whatever it is.
And they're not all singing with halos.
Not at all. It's like it can be really tough. And community life is the hardest thing because the Lord's put you together. You haven't like decided you're all going to live together because you've got mutual
likes and dislikes. Yeah.
It is always the fact that there's a reason why you're with these particular people and you're across to them and they're across to you. But also because of that blessing, because you've got to work through it and you come to know yourself more and more, which can be very confronting.
Mm-hmm.
But also that's why we're here. I mean, all of us is to know ourselves so that we can, not just so that like it's a this then that process, but in knowing ourselves, but with Christ with us, we come to love him more and to really know of his mercy because he is so merciful. Like we can't be afraid when these things come up in community and you can feel lousy or whatever, but he loves us in our lousiness or in our failings and our faults. He absolutely loves us, and it's through those that we can encounter him more deeply. You know, they're the things we want to give away first. We want the perfection, but we don't want to sit with the false intentions, which is natural. But that's what he's after, because that's all we have. Like he said to St. Faustina, all that you have that's yours is your sin. Give it to me.
Mm.
And that's something really hard to remember in the day-to-day, but that's what he's after, because that's where he'll transform us, because we have no control.
Mm.
In the sense of needing him, we absolutely need him. And so even though we want everything perfect in the natural way and our particular way, it's not going to be that way.
And it'll only make us more frustrated.
Exactly. And sometimes there's a real epiphany that comes when you think, okay, or you decide, all right, I'll do it her way. And in fact, you think that's actually much better. It takes a lot sometimes to get there. Or you might think, I really think this is a dumb idea. But you do it and it works and it turns out better than
humility. Humility kicks in
a big way. And you're like, well, and then you start to see the other gifts, you know. So it's like no one has all the gifts.
Mm.
You know, no one person has all the gifts. So you see in a microcosm of the community all the gifts working together, like Paul talks about parts of the body. And it's like, that's really true, you know. No one's got it all.
No. That was last Sunday, wasn't it?
It's true, it was. Yeah. It was very recent. Yeah, and it's so perfect when you're talking about religious life, family as well, but in this context of religious life, because you can think, oh, that one person's got all the gifts. And, I mean, jealousy, competitiveness, none of these things leave.
Mm. I mean, you see it in families. I have four daughters. And
Yeah.
It's always, she's got the brains, she's, you know, it goes on and on. I said, just stop. Stop. Comparison will kill you.
That is like such a golden motto. And it also travels into community life too, because whatever we're comparing with, whatever it is, our nature as women, we are always comparing. We can be possessive, even if it's of a holy card or, you know, something. There will always be me.
Possessive over the holy possessive. Card. That's
my bravery. It's like, gosh, like, and it doesn't take much, but it's in us. And so there's always room for conversion. We're human. And it's God calling human women for a supernatural call. And so these things we shouldn't be surprised at.
Yeah.
But
can you talk a little bit about that? We shouldn't be surprised at our sins and our faults, because I think that people are surprised when they realise, you know, they think, oh, I'm a good person, I recycle, you know, that kind of, and it stops there.
Yeah.
When they really look deeper.
I think that's a really good point, because a lot of the time the reason we're surprised by our sins is because we lack humility.
Mm.
And that applies to religious life too, because we really shouldn't be, we should be the opposite. I don't say this from experience, because I'm still trying to grow in humility myself, but when you look at all the great saints, you look at Christ as our iconic example, Our Lady, Christ didn't have sin. Our Lady, you know, was pure, but they are these most beautiful, merciful sort of icons for us, always loving, always compassionate. We're the ones, we who have sin and can sin and do sin, are so hard on ourselves in some ways and so lax in others. So when that example you gave, like, I'm a good person because I recycle, that's a good thing. But we can't stop there, because we're made for something more. We're not just, you know, spirited bodies living in a world. Like, we're made for eternity. We're made for being with God forever. So, but we are sinful. Like, we, all of us, by the very fact we're human, have failings. But those things aren't the end of the story. Like, the Lord wants those. Mm-hmm. He's going to work through those. And if we keep ignoring them and pushing them away, there's a part of ourselves that we deny to ourselves that's rich, because that's the part he can till, only he can till.
Mm-hmm.
It's the part of the garden in us, you could say, that we see is either rotting or decaying or really unattractive or needs to have the door shut on it so nobody sees it.
Close it
and forget about it. But he wants us to become free to open the door to him and only him and say, Lord, this is a disgusting, or this is a disordered, or this is a weak part of my garden, of my soul. Please come in and help me. And he'll come in and he will not stand there and say, yep, you're right, this is an absolute mess.
Yeah, shut the door, I'm walking away.
I'm disgusted and you're just a worthless human being. He would never, ever do that. He will come as the compassionate, loving, merciful Christ who loves us personally is, and be there and dwell there and work miracles, unleash miracles in there, in that total chaos, like, with love.
Yeah, like a gardener, an old man whistling and, you know, his shears, cutting branches away. He's not going to be there, like, ripping them out, complaining.
Absolutely. And this is why I love, you know, my patron, Blessed Julia of Norwich, because she talks about this image of Christ as a gardener and the joy that he, with which he comes to serve. This is so beautiful, because yes, we have sins, but this is what he wants. He wants to elevate us in love. And he so loves us. Like, he's so grateful to us for what we do for him, you know, however small. And he wants to make it more because that's what's good for us. And so, yeah, we often can delude ourselves. There's a lot of ways we can deceive ourselves as human beings that we're okay and we're not okay. In the sense of, the reason we're not okay is we're denying that we're weak, that we're dependent on Christ. And in denying that, we're denying him because we're not letting him in. And it's when we're brought to our knees with some catastrophe, some crisis, then we might turn to him, or we do, and he'll always come. But it's the everyday turning him in everything and saying, I need you. I feel just terrible today. Like, I'm weak and I'm failing at this, or I just don't, you know, I'm dry at prayer, or I'm just, you know, I had this encounter with someone and I, you know, feel like it didn't go well. To constantly bring him into our life through prayer, like a friend, like bringing him
conversation.
Conversation.
What is prayer? People would like, how do I pray? You just talk.
That's exactly right. You talk and you listen.
Yeah.
And it's like that active listening, like Our Lady, you know, it's not just a passive hearing. It's a asking questions, saying, you know, she asked, you know, how can this be? Like, that was a question. It was a prayer, not, you know, just, but it wasn't a pious raising of the mind immediately. It was I don't understand. And we need to do that too. Like, it's an active listening. It's a questioning, receiving, and really not being afraid to be quiet, because that can be very hard for us in our busy world.
Yesterday I went on a bushwalk with my husband, and I tend to put my earbuds in, you know, listen to a podcast, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to take them out and I'm just going to not listen to anything. I'm going to be quiet and you're going to talk to me through the ocean and through the birds. And it was
a beautiful example, because even that, like, that choice to take out those earbuds, like, that's huge.
And it's hard.
It's not easy. Yeah, I mean, it's not a bad thing to listen to music, but it's like, we do disconnect from the world, you know, not from malice or anything, but just because we're used to it. It's a habit, maybe, or it's,
but it could also be to numb out.
It could be to numb out, yeah. And you see when you're in the street, I mean, everyone's on their phone, everyone's just engaged from, even when they're a group of friends together, all their phones individually, but it's like, we're not present to one another, so we don't know how to be present to Christ. And it's, I think, remembering the presence of Christ, being in the presence of Christ. And habituating ourselves, like, he's always with me. But I think starting just on the level of one another, which makes us vulnerable. Especially. And so when we're present to one another, we're vulnerable, because we have to receive and be received and risk not being received as we want.
Even to be looked at in the eyes.
That's right. Yeah.
Like, that's being vulnerable.
That's being vulnerable.
And people,
absolutely,
like, they turn away.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to be seen, because they fear that we will see them.
Yeah. And there is something, that saying, the eyes are the windows of the soul. We feel that as human beings. We know it. Even if it's not manifest, or we don't express it like that. There is something about people seeing us through our eyes that we're afraid of, maybe.
Because, they don't want us to really see them.
Yeah.
We all want to be seen, but to a point. We want to see our best. So I think, taking the buds out, being more engaged, looking at people.
Absolutely. And that makes a difference. It could change someone's day. Just walking on the street and encountering someone behind
them. And that's prayer.
That is a prayer, exactly. It's loving your neighbour. It's saying, I'm here for you, literally. Like, I will look you in the eye, say good morning. If I'm at, you know, the checkout, whatever, to say, engage with you, just even saying good morning or hello or something, just looking, like you say, just looking at them, smiling. It's a risk, but it's for them.
That's beautiful. I think we're running out of time. But I forgot to tell you before, you have to tell me something that brought you joy this week. Can you think something?
I can think of a lot of things, actually.
Just one.
I was in the Blue Mountains.
I'll give you two.
Okay, I was in the Blue Mountains on the weekend with the sisters. Oh. And two things brought me. The first one was when we went to an exhibition in the Everglades.
It was a beautiful house there.
Absolutely stunning. There was a young woman there. We went and there was an art exhibition, and she had Down syndrome. She was the artist, and her mother was there. And they're the two most beautiful people. We didn't really know. We strolled in and we're looking around. It was lovely. She had all this color and just talking to those two was incredibly uplifting. They brought so much joy to us. I mean, we were the receivers that day. So I would say definitely that one. Because they were so.
How old was she?
I think she was in her early 20s, but incredibly happy and giving, both of them really. And that was expressed in the young girl's art. And I'd say the second thing was walking and seeing all the families in the parks and their joy of being together, and particularly one family at Mass. A Mass we went to on the Feast of St. Thomas Aquinas, the couple celebrated there. I think it was their 16th year of marriage. They had six kids. And just to know that there we were sitting in the church where we need each other, we need all the vocations. And so they were so joyful. The kids were running around, one of them screaming, as kids do. But it was just so beautiful that they were giving thanks, giving to God for their marriage and for their kids. And that we could actually share in that. So definitely has to be the second.
No, well, I had a similar one. Because we've got a place at Terrigal, so we go up there. So the parish up there is very vibrant. Mm. It's beautiful, Our Lady Star of the Sea. But there was a wedding anniversary. I think it was 50-year wedding anniversary.
Wonderful.
And they got – and I'm emotional, as you have encountered. I'm in tears.
Great.
It was so beautiful, and my kids are looking at here she goes again. Like, I try to lift my head up so the tears go back in. But it was such a beautiful witness to see good, strong marriages.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful response, actually. It's so human. I mean, you're sharing
it. Oh, I'm very human.
Thanks be to God. But, yeah, it is. There's something very uplifting about that.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Thank
it was
you
a
for
pleasure
it
talking
was,
to you.
Well, thank you, Jess, for everything.
I will leave all the details in the show notes, your order and where they can find you.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, perfect.
Great.
I can send that.
Thanks.
Great. Thank you.
Bye.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.